afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, today to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. And today is Friday, April 20th, 2018. Good afternoon, Dave.
Happy Fun Friday, Melody.
Happy Fun Friday. And finally, we get a little bit of a warm, sunshiny day here on the eastern shore of Maryland. And I'm not sure it's going to stay for long. The nights are still getting a little cool. But it's finally coming, ladies and gentlemen. But planting, you know, they say you got to wait till Memorial Day to do your planting on the east, northeast. So I guess perhaps this could be normal weather that we're actually having. So, but who cares when the markets are all over the place today? And we did have pressure on gold today. We had a stronger dollar, and we'll start there today, Dave. We have gold was down about $10 today at $1,336. Silver was down 9 cents today, but still at $17.23. Platinum was down 8 at $931, and palladium was up a couple bucks at $1,036. The USDX today was up by 0.39, so we're looking at 90.28, with crude oil down 3 pennies at 68.26. Paper markets today came back from their lows. The Dow's looking down about 200 points, a little over 200, at 24,463. The NASDAQ is down 91 points at 71.46. The S&P is down 23 at 2,670. Now the 10-year yield up over 1.25%, 2.95% on the 10-year yield, 2.95%, getting close. And those are big pops. That means bonds are being sold, rates have to rise, and tested these levels before in February. We'll have to see if it goes above that $3 level and the impacts that it might have. Of course, the euro was weaker today. European markets and Asian markets were pretty much flat overnight. And the fear and greed index, the emotion that drives the market, we're at number 38 for fear. So it's a pretty far off from that level of 7. Again, it's just like, where are the people? Where's the world? Do people even think it?
Running for the hills, Melody.
They're running for the hills. Well, you know, I'm not so sure about that yet, but they will be. And I hope they have their gold and silver to take along with them. But so we did have some pressure on the dollar. Everyone's debating the cause of the decline in sovereign debt. You have the bond market gauges showed an increase in expectations for U.S. inflation. And after the recent torrid gains in metals from aluminum to nickel, trade remains in focus with the U.S. Treasury. Now they're beginning to consider using an emergency law. You know, I mean, how many, it is getting kind of concerning that, you know, every time something isn't going the way it should, their D.C. is using these emergency laws that date back. We talked about one yesterday about our energy, and, you know, we've talked about for these trade tariffs, for these tariffs to be placed on various products, other emergency laws and so forth are being used. So now here's another one that the U.S. Treasury Department is considering using an emergency law to curb Chinese investments in sensitive technologies. It makes me very uncomfortable when you're seeing this, and is it good? I don't know. I mean, I don't know what to think, but I think it's something that we have to wait and see. We talked about, is this another way to nationalize? We talked about nationalizing the various energy yesterday. So I don't know. It's to have it all happen at once. I guess that's what's bothering me, Dave. If they used one for one particular reason, and then, you know, it all kind of made sense and so forth, I'd go for it. But they're being used, you know, they're digging them, they're blowing the dust off, and I don't know, maybe they were there for a reason, and maybe they're using them for their proper reason, I don't know. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But so it's interesting to see that 10-year yield climbing to the 2.5%, and again, that's the highest in 8 weeks. I don't think there was really any, you know, other than tech stocks are part of the claim that the markets are dropping. So I don't know what kind of day to view today as. I think it's going to be an interesting week next week. We had taxes that were all due this week, so a lot of people were distracted. You had the tax computers that were down one day, so they were extended another, and so forth. So a lot of distractions this week. And so I think particularly with Comey and all the interviews and all that going on. But we talked a little bit about this, I think I did in the morning show, not sure if we did in this program earlier in the week, but how the Associated Press is showing that the nation's six big Wall Street banks saved at least $3.59 billion in taxes last quarter, and of course that is to the recently enacted tax law reform. Banks typically kick off the earnings seasons with their reports for the January-March quarter. They're giving investors and the public their first glimpse into how the new law is compacting corporate America. Banks historically paid some of the highest taxes due to their U.S.-centric business model. Before the Trump tax cuts, these banks paid between 28 to 31% of their income each year, and the results show why banks supported the tax overhaul, of course, and now they want less regulation so they can go out, and they're making historic profits. Historic profits. And hey, take off the regulation so they can go out and, you know, make more and pay us even less. You know, they make all these profits, and what do they pay on your savings? You know, we talk about having to go back to the gold-backed currency, but they also need to get rid of this fractional reserve banking.
Well, if they were doing it more ethically, too, you know, you could stomach it. But, you know, now we see they're now luring unqualified people by the tens of thousands into subprime auto and mortgage loans, and it's just not right. In a moment, we'll be talking about Wells Fargo, who's going to see their certainly their after tax and after fine profits decrease, but a little more on that in a few minutes, Melody. You know, and at the same time, banks are reaping more profits. I mean, buying a home has gotten a little more expensive. I mean, mortgage rates, which, as we tell you, follow the 10-year treasury loosely, but nevertheless still do. They hit their highest level since the end of March, breaking out of a tight range where they've been sitting for the last couple of weeks. The move came as bond yields surged higher after a big sell-off in the bond market. Now, while the mortgage increase won't mean a lot in terms of the average monthly payment for a home buyer, it still could be signaling the start of another steady rise, which we saw at the beginning of this year, Melody. The bond yield surge yesterday and again today brought additional confirmation at the end of the friendly springtime consolidation trend, and it looks like it took us one more step closer to the highest yields in at least more than 4 years. Now, as the average rate of the 30-year fixed mortgage moves past 4.6%, talk of even 5% comes back into play, and that's an emotional barrier for both buyers and sellers. Millennials, who are now the largest home buying demographic, are still struggling with the decision to continue renting or jump into home ownership. As we reported a few months ago, millennials have the highest rental or non-home ownership rate as any generation since World War II, or the end of World War II. Rising interest rates have this pretty major impact on this young generation, not only because of mortgage rates, which they're loath to commit to, but also they have this very high level of student loan debt. Many of them were underemployed after they graduated, and that's left them with a lot less savings than previous generations did at this point in their lives. So we'll see what happens. You know, the market desperately needs more homes, especially entry-level homes, where these millennial sellers could be entering and others moving up.
We don't have any affordable homes for anyone, but you know, I remember our generation, if you didn't have the money to go to college, you didn't go. You didn't go into debt, you know, for thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars to go to college and not have a job when you come out. You didn't go. You went to work, and that's part of the problem. This country doesn't have jobs, so these kids go to school. Thinking they can get a better job, and, you know, perhaps in their you know, future along their future prospects for jobs and so forth, and interviews and everything, it will help them. But again, I mean, we didn't go to college if we didn't afford it. We worked our way through to pay our college. People didn't go into debt to go to college. So again, to me, I think college has sort of been created so everyone can go, and these debts have been created for these kids because there isn't anything else for them to do. You know, there isn't, you can't work your way up like you could at one point in time. I mean, you could, you know, get a job in an office somewhere, and, you know, if you worked hard and, you know, you could promote yourself throughout the company. And you can't do that anymore. It's very much, much, much more difficult to do that if you can, you know, at all anymore at an entry level. So they do have it tough, but, And tuition, why is tuition getting so much higher? Huh? It's all part of the inflation trick. That's why prices continue to rise. Your dollar buys less. Everything goes higher. So Wells Fargo's, their fines are going higher. They're going to be fined another $1 billion to settle U.S. probes into mistreatment on consumers. Any other company that would have done this, created the fraud, they would have been, they'd be out of business. You know, $1 billion is a lot of money, but who went to jail? No one. I don't think anybody went to jail. They probably made $5 billion or more on the fake accounts and so forth, and how, you know, all that they did. But this is the largest sanction of a U.S. bank under this administration. And you have the firm trying to resolve a year and a half of scandals across its operations. So at least it's something. $1 billion is certainly better than millions that they usually get. So I have to say kudos to the president this time if he was behind this. The bank will pay $500 million in penalties, each to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, according to the CFPB. And Wells Fargo did warn their shareholders last week that it would soon face a fine of that size, and the bank remains under a Federal Reserve penalty that bans growth in total assets.
Yeah, that settlement, Melody, covers issues in Wells Fargo's auto lending and mortgage units. Bank admitted last year that it had forced unwanted insurance on customers who took out car loans. And that prompted investigations by both U.S. and California regulators. Wells Fargo was also accused of imposing inappropriate charges for locking in interest rates on new home loans. Their newer CEO, Tim Sloan, who took the helm after the scandals began erupting in 2016, changed management, promised to overhaul the bank's culture and controls to rebuild the public trust. Now, the ensuing scrutiny, some issued by initiated by the bank itself, exposed more conduct that had festered for years. Wells Fargo, let's see. And this is going to be the second straight quarter that legal costs hurt the bank's results. In the fourth quarter, Wells Fargo booked a record $3.25 billion charge related to regulatory investigations, sales practices, and other matters. Looks like they're not going to have a whole lot of room left over for bonuses for their rank and file, although I suspect that their management will get what they usually do. Melody?
Usually they do. And of course, who knows, that they're not supposed to make additional assets, but with the tax reform, I wonder how they fared for the tax reform. Everybody else did, so I'm assuming they did too. We got a little bit, about a little over a minute before we go into the break. So when we come back, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be talking about OPEC and oil prices. And we had Donald Trump slam OPEC for inflating oil prices. And we'll talk about that. And I saw a headline today about North Korea no longer demands U.S. troops to be removed from South Korea. This is another groundbreaking step toward peace deals on the Korean Peninsula from North Korea's Kim Jong-un. He's no longer demanding that the U.S. withdraw all troops from South Korea as a condition for a denuclearization plan. And again, he knows he has Russia behind him. He knows he has China behind him. You know, he doesn't care if he has nukes. He's got the two biggest bears standing behind him. So what does he have to lose anymore? And South Korea, I mean, they want this deal to be done, again, because of the oil to run, or not the oil, but the natural gas to be running from Russia through North Korea down to South Korea. So they're building up quite a bit of a zone, so to speak, in that area. And so he's not going to demand that U.S. troops withdraw. We should. I don't know why we should stay there. But this seems to be progressing towards a pretty good peace deal. I don't know what else the U.S. could ask that would throw, a crimp into the deal. So it should go along with no problem if they're willing to denuclearize and leave our troops there. So we'll be talking more about oil and how that might have an impact on the deal, perhaps. We'll be returning in just a few short minutes. We will find you acting on your best behavior.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk CommonSenseVoicesOfIntegrity.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, and it is Friday, April 20th. And remember, folks, we have a little pullback in gold and silver, so give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com, and make sure you sign up for our weekly newsletter. What else do I need to say? We still have the 90% BU dimes that are available. $25. I mean, you can buy $50 face value. You can buy a half bag or a full bag if you want. But we do divide them up so they go a little bit further, the $25 face value of the 90%. And they are a great deal. Very, very good pricing for the BU dimes. So we do have some 1/10 ounce. American 10th ounce, 1/10 ounce American Gold Eagles. We can also include them with your package. So both of them are great little bartering items, and if you like the smaller fractional pieces. Heading into the break, we were going to talk about a little bit about how President Trump is slamming OPEC over the oil prices. And, you know, anymore, Dave, I don't even know, because, you know, the relationship, you know, the cozy relationship that this administration had with OPEC, you know, I'm sure he's slamming, but I don't know what can be done to it.
Me neither, but the president has openly criticized OPEC for inflating oil prices after the cartel showed, you know, its willingness to further tighten the crude markets the past week. The president's ire followed a stream of bullish signals from a meeting of oil producers in Saudi Arabia, chiefly from the kingdom's energy minister, Khalid Al-Fali. The crude glut that's weighed on prices for 3 years has almost been wiped out by OPEC's production cuts. But instead of celebrating victory, the group's finding reasons to keep on going and drive fuel inventories even lower. Brent crude, which is the international oil trademark benchmark, fell about 69 cents at the time of the tweet before trading down about 1% as of mid-afternoon London time. Melody?
Well, you know, the shift in their OPEC's target could be clear. You know, Al-Fali said that there's a capacity for prices to rise even further beyond the current three-year high. You had the international oil prices, they surged to almost $75 a barrel this week. U.S. gasoline is the highest in almost 3 years. I filled up today, and yeah, it cost me an additional $10. So, yeah, it's not going to break me, but it's irritating. $10. And so, you know, when you're looking at families that don't have savings at all, you know, $10 and their credit card minimums, you know, it's $10 a week. You know, that's an additional $40 a month. There goes their tax savings if they received any at all. But you have OPEC's chokehold on its own production is only getting tighter. And Saudi Arabia said to desired crude closer to $80. The closest U.S. allies within the OPEC rejected Trump's accusations. Prices aren't artificially high, said the United Arab Emirates oil minister. He says they're doing what they can. They're doing their role to correct the market. There are many things affecting the market, not just supply and demand. You're also looking at geopolitics. that are beyond anyone's control. You have Russia, Saudi Arabia's most important ally in the production of cuts, gave its backing to continuing their cuts until their end 2018 expiration. We have, you know, there's certainly oil prices are going higher, and I don't think there's anything that anyone can do to stop them at this point in time.
Well, you know, except for perhaps soaring U.S. shale production, Melody. That's been a nagging concern for OPEC and its allies, but the group's key players appear to be more fixated on the immediate benefit of high crude prices. You know, Saudi Arabia needs to cover weighty domestic spending and to attract investors to a partial sale of its state oil company, Aramco. Russia's relishing its new role as a major Middle East power broker, while also enjoying bigger financial gains than anyone from the accord. Now, again, Saudi Arabia is talking about a 2019 extension. And Russia is keeping all options open. So for now, the group is cutting even deeper, and Saudi Arabia, you know, is chiding nations that haven't been implementing their fair share of the curbs at the opening session of their talks. Overall, OPEC and its allies cut 49% deeper than the agreed 1.8 million barrels a day in March. That, according to the OPEC statement, that's the biggest reduction ever. And the seventh month, the group has surpassed its target.
Well, you know, there's a couple of things that could be done that could keep the prices somewhat at least steady. And, of course, that would be, as the OPEC ministers meet Saudi Arabia, you could keep the Iran deal in place. You know, there's a lot of fear that that is going to, there will be, the U.S. will reimpose its sanctions on Iran. That deal comes up for will come up for a review again next month. You know, so that might add a little uncertainty in the market. Maybe we're seeing a little bit of that. You could be lifting sanctions on Venezuela. We all know the problems that they have. Their problems really started when the price of oil dropped down to the $20-$25 level. And so, you know, if you lift those sanctions off of Venezuela, it might help with the prices. There's several other things that perhaps could be done.
Well, there's repealing the Jones Act. Someone has said this came up actually during the post hurricane Puerto Rico crisis. Section 27 of that law, which was passed back in 1920, requires that goods transported by ship between U.S. ports be carried on vessels built and flagged in the U.S. and owned and manned by U.S. citizens. That drives up the cost of shipping U.S. crude from the Gulf Coast, for example, to the refineries on the East Coast, which often use international oil instead. And also, there's another suggestion, half tongue-in-cheek, but probably half not. Oil prices fell 1.6% immediately following our president's tweet. So maybe the most effective thing he can do in the near term is exactly what he doesn't like to do, stop talking.
I know. I relayed to. I watched it when he was asked a question when he was at a press conference with Abby the other day. And I mean, he answered the question beautifully, but then he just kept on talking and he just ruined the whole thing. And what he said was what the press is waiting for him to say. That's what they run on. And it's just like if he just stopped. I mean, I even saw Obama used to do the same thing. He'd say something, then he'd go on and keep talking. It's just like, shut up.
Stop. If our presidents, and they're very few in our lifetime that are exceptions to this, but if our presidents, just as a rule, met with the press more often. I mean, I think that, you know, they feel insulated. And they don't have that FaceTime with the press. I mean, obviously, you know, Trump has Sarah Huckabee Sanders, you know, to do her daily press briefing. But I think he just has to get in more of the in front of the press more. Maybe, you know, he might be the exception to that. But I mean, other presidents, I think, had they been more, you know, not felt more insulated and disconnected from the press, they may have been more constrained in their talking when they when they finally got before him and were asked questions that, you know, deserve yes or no, and all of a sudden it's 10 minutes later. What was your second question? No, I forget, Mr. President.
Yeah. Although we always say that Reagan was always the best communicator, he seemed to do the job well.
He was such a poised orator, and a great humorist to boot.
Yes, and so he had those things going for him, but I don't think we've had anyone like him since, as far as that abilities, for those abilities. You know, we talk a lot about our debt. We talk about, you know, how troubling it is. We have 25 million low-income households that earn $23,000 or less, facing growing burdens. You have 20 of the bottom 20% of income earners stressed in 2016, up from 45% in 2013. I mean, I could go on and on and on and talk about, you know, the so much debt in these families. You know, Americans continue to borrow heavily, and there's no savings. And that's one thing that is different about our debt here in the United States. A lot of those other countries that carry a lot of debt, the citizens have savings. China, you talk about China's debt, but the citizens have savings and they have gold. Government encourages them to buy gold. In this country, the government tells you not to buy gold. They want you to buy paper. They want you to go into debt. So it's a little bit different. And, you know, it's all controlled by the Federal Reserve. And, but, you know, when we talk about the middle class, and I know people get upset with the middle class that, you know, we have no more middle class anymore and so forth and whatnot. But, you know, it always we look to see what the Federal Reserve does. We all know it's you know, we're not fans of the Federal Reserve. They need to be audited, and they actually should be closed. But, you know, they do determine to create some sort of wealth effects throughout the economy. The Fed's objective is to make American households feel wealthier, and they do this by pushing up the valuations of stocks and bonds. This paper wealth mentality, yeah, it's worked great. It's worked great for Wall Street. It's worked great for the 1%, but it's really, truly has destroyed the middle class as this wealth inequality continues to skyrocket. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, he went on record. He warned of a massive bond and stock bubble due to these historic low interest rates. The idea of rising paper wealth to drive a wave of renewed borrowing and spending really hasn't quite worked out as planned. And sadly, most households have been squeezed as the majority of the wealth created has only gone to the top 5% of households that earn in excess of $200,000 annually. Meanwhile, the bottom 95% has suffered.
Yeah, you know, Melody, we used to live in a time where we're making a six-figure paycheck was that was a lot of money. But parts of the U.S. are simply unaffordable for most of middle America. I mean, you got San Francisco, where you have to earn as much as $110,000 to be even considered in the top 50% of earners, and that according to the U.S. Census. Now, it's evident that these wealth effects that the Fed's been chasing doesn't drive inflation-adjusted wages at the bottom 95% that have stagnated for decades. I mean, it merely accelerates the purchasing power decay, where the 1% gets the wealth first, and then it, whatever's left trickles down to the rest of the economy.
And, you know, this great experiment of prolonged zero interest rates, it's destroyed savers. And it rewarded us with reckless spenders, and they have helped push household debt to unprecedented levels. I mean, it's just shy of $19 trillion as we speak.
Amazing.
The 2008 Band-Aid, one of these days they are going to rip that off. And it's going to hurt the middle class even more and drive wealth and income inequality even further.
You know, speaking of income inequality and as further evidence of a world teetering on the edge of excess and sheer insanity, I mean, hey, it's Friday. We got to have a little fun. So here's like our 1 minute sidebar. I mean, a London court has ordered the seizure of a luxury $492 million yacht owned by a Russian billionaire as judges there sought to enforce one of the largest divorce payouts in UK history. The court ruled, Melody, that Farkad Akhmedov should transfer ownership of the 380-foot Luna, currently impounded in Dubai, to his wife, Tatiana. The judge granted the order to uphold his earlier $646 million judgment. Presumably, that's the amount that goes also to Tatiana in addition to the yacht. The judge said that Akhmedov tried to hide his ownership of the Luna behind a group of companies and moved the ship to Dubai on the belief that it was well beyond the reach of an English court judgment. Not so, Farkad, not so. The nine-deck yacht, Melody, which has nine decks, 50 crew members, two helipads, was originally built for Roman Abramovich before Akhmedov purchased it in 2014. Well, what we can say is good riddance, Luna. May Tatiana sell it and distribute the proceeds to poor people all around the world.
That is incredible. Nine decks. 50 crew. Wow. And you know, but you know what's interesting about this whole article is that the UK does have that reach to Dubai. And you know, to me, I think that's interesting. To where we talk about, you know, globalization and you know, global government and so forth and courts. There's no boundaries. Are there any boundaries anymore? Perhaps some, but not many. And you know, that's how I see it. But, you know, so her total divorce is $1 billion.
Looks like it.
Yeah, almost $1 billion.
Oh. Not too chintzy.
Not too chintzy. Well, maybe she could buy some silver, because silver is ready to, is poised for a big jump, and that could be the next big thing in the making. There's a shortage in the silver market, and it could result in a massive increase in silver prices, and we'll talk about that when we get back.
Won't you lay it on the line? I need to hear it just one more time. Tell me again. Oh, can you feel it? Oh, won't you tell me again tonight? Each and every heart is
food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today. today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. Heading into the break, we all know silver is going to do very well. It's an industrial metal now, and when everything hits the fan, people will turn to silver, and silver will convert back to a monetary metal. Right now, it's trading as an industrial metal, and we're beginning to see, and this has been reported on extensively, that possible shortages in the silver market. And of course, we see this, we can see heavy tolls on the mining companies. They become too comfortable when the times are good. Their cost of production shot through the roof when silver prices were moving higher. We saw silver trading at $50 in 2011. Now we're a little over $17, touching on $15 back in 2015. So, that's a big drop, about a 70% drop from the highs. And again, ladies and gentlemen, excuse me, buy low, sell high. This is the perfect time. Buy low, sell high. What's too high? All of your paper investments. What's low? Gold and silver. So this is where you want to be. And this is where you convert yourself out of the paper and you hold until the time. There will be a time to get back into paper, but it isn't now. And you just have to sit and wait for these things to happen, because you have to follow the fundamentals. You know, I hear people out there following trends. Yeah, you could pick up trends here and there, but in a manipulated world of prices and everything else, it's kind of hard to find a trend until you have some significant moves, and then you can look at some, then the trends begin to play in a little bit more. But, silver is a great deal at this point in time. Premiums are down because of this, and because silver has been trading at lows. And so a great time to be picking up some silver. In Canada, silver production faces scrutiny as well. Mine output mounted to 13.87 million ounces in 2017. In 2016, this amount was 14.27. million. So again, you're seeing a 2.7% decline year over year. So, and I can remember right before silver begins to take off, you'll have mines closing and you'll see them stop production on their bars and so forth. And it's all great buying opportunities for you. So take advantage of it. And when, you hear us talking about silver is poised for a big jump, that's because it is. And it hasn't even followed the increase as we've seen with gold. Gold has been performing very well of late, and silver has been lagging. So again, same way with platinum. Platinum is lagging. And I think a lot of it has to do with the sanctions on Russia, is why palladium is running so high. So there's a lot of things to it. And when we got into a weaker dollar and markets started dropping, we saw palladium drop and platinum rise to where we were at basically parity of the two. And now we have palladium pulling out in advance. And again, I think it has a lot to do with the sanctions in Russia and so forth. So take a look at your portfolios and get the prices. While not only are prices are low, premiums are low. So now's the time to get into it. And we're going to talk a little bit more about Social Security. I know it's important for everyone. And the big question is, we all know, I believe, Social Security is broke. Millennials, there's more millennials than there are baby boomers. So can anyone actually believe that there will be any Social Security for these kids? Absolutely not. How can it be? When you have inflation in a fiat currency and your dollar continues to get weaker and your purchasing power declines and government continues to throw IOUs in there because they're you know, to support their spending habits. It's just irritating, Dave. It's disgusting.
Irritating, but as they say, reasonable people can disagree. You know, is Social Security broke, or is it in hospice care with a do not resuscitate directive? Well, as you alluded, a majority of millennials believe it won't be around when they retire. Or is it just fine? Not nearly as bad as skeptics tell us, and maybe only in need of a little tweaking here and there. Well, however you may view it, Social Security is a vital part of the lives of Americans 62 and older. You know, some basics, Social Security actually consists of two programs, the old age and survivor's insurance and the disability insurance programs, together OASDI. The OASDI program makes monthly income available to insured workers and their families at retirement, death, or disability. Retirement payments dating back to, you know, its founding in the 1930s, in theory, are supposed to replace about 40% of a worker's average monthly earnings while working. Now, benefits are paid out of one of two trust funds, which are financed primarily by payroll taxes on employers, employees, and the self-employed. Now, only earnings up to a maximum, $128,400 this year, are subject to the tax. That maximum usually increases each year at the same rate as the average wages in the economy. Social Security tax rate is 12.4% of earnings, 6.2% of which is deducted from employee paychecks, the other 6.2% paid by employers, while self-employed individuals generally pay all 12.4% of their net employment income with somewhat of a tax deduction at tax time. Now, the end of 2016, that's the most recent year for which there's an official report from Social Security, the OASDI program was providing benefit payments to about 61 million people. That includes 44 million retired workers and their dependents, 6 million survivors of deceased workers, and 11 million disabled workers and their dependents. During the year, an estimated 171 million people had earnings covered by Social Security and paid payroll taxes on those earnings.
Well, you know, this trust fund expenditures in 2016 were $922 billion. Total income was $957, which consisted of $869 billion in non-interest income, largely payroll taxes, and $88 billion in interest earnings. Asset reserves held in special issue U.S. securities grew from $2.8 trillion at the beginning of the year to $2.848 trillion at the end of the year. These are the numbers that come from Social Security Trustees 2016 report. Are there any other important findings that could be found there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Bottom line, Melody, from this 2016 report, Social Security can pay full benefits into the mid-2030s, but will then face a significant but manageable funding shortfall. Some key points from that report are, the trustees, who are appointed by different folks to oversee Social Security policy execution, they estimate that if policymakers take no further action, i.e. Congress, Social Security's combined OASDI trust fund reserves will have a funding shortfall starting in 2034. After 2034, Social Security could still pay three-fourths of scheduled benefits using its tax income alone, even if Congress took no steps to shore up the program. Now, those who claim that Social Security won't be around at all when today's young adults retire and that young workers will receive no benefits might misunderstand these projections. The program shortfall amounts to 1% of GDP over the next 75 years and about 1.5% of GDP in the 75th year. Now, another key finding, the worker-to-rate beneficiary ratio could fall by 21% by 2035. That's a lot of what's going to start driving the shortfall, just that payouts are going to start exceeding income because there are going to be less workers to support people getting the benefits. And that's going to get higher and higher as the years go on and the baby boomers are in full force. It's just the current number of workers simply can't support the number of beneficiaries. Also, the life expectancy, that average has risen by 18 years since Social Security was created in 1935, from 61 to 79. The program as designed just isn't capable of supporting retirees for more than 20 years. Over 62% of seniors, Melody, rely on Social Security for at least half of their retirement income, and a little more than a third get at least 90% of their monthly income from there. An American's personal savings rate is a meager 2 to 3.5%. That's not even a third of what our parents and theirs were saving 50 years ago. Thus, it's no surprise that many of us has to lean heavily on Social Security to make it in retirement.
You know, I mean, I'm a believer that it's broke. I'm a believer that a lot of these numbers that the Social Security produces are based on today. And I believe we have a fiat currency and their purchasing power, Social Security retirees. It takes more and more of those dollars to buy things. Their little rate increases for inflation don't amount to anything. And I think, how can anybody even live on the numbers that people get from their Social Security? I mean, so they do have to have another form of savings. And again, American savings rate is paltry. I mean, there's just nothing there. And I really don't know how people do it. I mean, if you read the headline data in the trustees report in 2034, and that's what, 15 years away. I mean, that's not that long. That's not that, you know, when you say 2035, 2030, that seems like a long time, but it isn't. I mean, that's, if we go back to the Great Recession, that was 10 years. I mean, it really is it's sort of mind-boggling when you think of the dates. But in that report, the headline date, the trustees report says that if nothing else is done, the program could then pay 77% of scheduled benefits. And that figure would slip to 73% in 75 years. Doesn't that prove that Social Security will be broke?
No, I don't think it proves that at all, at least not right away. And also it depends on what your definition of broke is. I mean, in fact, contrary to popular belief, benefits wouldn't stop in 2034 or whenever the trust funds would start having, you know, funding shortfalls. But a funding shortfall, nevertheless, is something to watch and to ward off, because it could lead to long-term financial distress to the trust funds and an eventual funding crisis. I mean, in theory, a shortfall could create a worst-case no-win political situation, one that results in the federal government having to decide between borrowing additional money to fund a proportion of Social Security benefits or temporarily reducing benefit payments to retirees. Again, that is unless the Congress takes action before the tipping point. In fact, the trustees project that the trust funds, their reserves will start to have shortfalls within 11 to 15 years. Hopefully that alone causes Congress to address Social Security comprehensively and sooner rather than later.
You know, I guess there can be a lot of myths and misconceptions about Social Security. We find it in everything that we read. Social Security, its funding, you know, can often create an unnecessary division. With not understanding, and I guess that's what we're trying to do here, is try to pick a point, pick apart, and so forth, and naming the myths.
Yeah, there are several of them, and trying to pick one to talk about. I thought, you know, since its creation in 1935, Social Security trust funds have never been part of the federal government's general fund. So politicians haven't been free to spend the money on agency operations and their pet projects, at least directly. But they do seem to find ways, don't they? I mean, in a nutshell, here's how it works. I mean, every day the IRS collects the payroll taxes paid by workers and their employers. This revenue is immediately invested in interest-bearing U.S. Treasury securities and credited to either of the two trust funds. And then by law, income to the trust funds have to be invested in securities whose principal and interest are guaranteed by the federal government. These securities are called special issues of the U.S. Treasury. I mean, technically, they're called Government Account Series Securities, GAS for short. These securities are only available to the trust funds. They're not marketable securities that are available to the general public. So their par value or prices don't go up and down according to demand and supply and other things. But, you know, meanwhile, the government spends the proceeds raised from the sale of the GAS securities, you know, on a wide range of programs and projects that have authorized appropriations from Congress. But Social Security regularly redeems maturing securities from the Treasury to pay its obligatory retirement, disability, and death benefits. Now, because the government spends this borrowed cash, some people see the trust fund assets as an accumulation of securities that the government someday will be unable to make good on. And in fact, that's a leap of faith. One, you know, regardless of how you feel about the program's solvency, that, you know, I think in good faith, you've got to admit. But I think far from being worthless IOUs, and, you know, I know that many listeners will scoff at this, but the investments held by the trust funds are backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, and that's always repaid Social Security on time and with interest. But I admit, caveat emptor, ask does not prologue.
One thing I do know is we are out of time, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be back Monday, so I'm looking forward to spending the hour with you. Please have a safe weekend, and good night, and God bless.
Bye-bye. I have a plan. If I got me